Sahanavavatu, Sahanau Punaktu, Sahaviryam Karavahai, Tejasvinavatitamastu Mavitvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
How can the mind will itself towards certain thoughts? The self is the one that is aware of the mind and the one that directs it. How can it be the director of the mind if it has no desire to do so, no will to do so? The mind seems to be directed. This is from the first verse of the Kena Upanishad, right? Kena Shitam Patiti Preshitam Manaha. So the directed mind goes toward its objects, desired by whom? So it's not really, as that verse unfolds, it's not that the self, that the Atma, is directing the mind, but it's more like saying, who, by the presence of whom? You know, who is there, by whose presence does the mind then become directed toward its given objects? That's like the idea there is like if there's a house is built, it's not built for itself, right? Like you don't put in the nice, all of the different rooms and the kitchen and all of the furniture and everything. It's not being done for the house itself. The couch is not for the couch. The couch is for me. The one who wants to lie on the couch. And so the idea here is, it says desired by whom, but that's going to resolve itself into in whose presence. Who is it for? Who is this body operating for? That is the idea. Because it's, if you have a conglomerate, like this body is considered a conglomerate, made of many, many different parts put together that are functioning as a whole, but who is it functioning for? You know, and so that is the question. For whom is this, in whose presence is this all taking place? An example is the self like a magnet that's drawing all of these things to behave in a particular way? Or is it like the king who doesn't actually do anything, but whatever the king desires gets done, but itself is separate in a sense from all of the activities? So what is this, who is the self, and for whom is this, all of this happening? For whom is this body? So that's what the question means there. Then it says the self is the one that is aware of the mind. Now, this is the language problem that we have to keep working on, because the self is not aware of the mind. That would mean like the self is aware, means it is performing an act of being aware of the mind. It's not performing any such act. It is the awareness because of which the mind is known. But we are so used to attributing knowership to the mind, I mean to the self. It's hard to kind of break that habit. The self is not a knower. In the Sankhya, there's a big problem in terms of their own logic, because they will somehow misspeak, I would say, in some ways, where they talk about the Purusha as being a knower. They actually, their logic is taking the Purusha, the pure conscious being, to be a knower. And they, because of taking the Purusha to be a knower, everyone has to have their own Purusha. So that's why you have a Purusha, you have a Purusha. Because this is their logic. If there was only one Purusha, and Purusha is like the Atma, a conscious being, pure conscious being, infinite, pure infinite conscious being. So everyone has to have their own, because if the conscious being is a knower, then if there was only one knower, then I would know what all of you are thinking, right? Because I am the knower, and I would be the one who knows all minds. Doesn't that make sense? I mean, if I'm the knower, if I am the one knower, then everything that is known by me, because I'm the knower of all of these things. But that isn't our experience. This is the Sankhya talking. What our experience is that I know my mind, and you know your mind, and you know your mind. I don't know your mind. And so that's because they're attributing knowership to the Purusha, what they call the Purusha, or to consciousness itself, which is a very good argument. I mean, if consciousness was a knower, then there couldn't be one consciousness, because then the consciousness would know everything if it's a knower. Consciousness is not a knower. Consciousness is consciousness, not consciousness of something. That's why when you think of the Maya as sattva, rajas, and tamas, Maya is these three. Sattva is what allows for the manifestation or the reflection. You can use either way, because neither one is appropriate, but we have to use language. So that which is sattva as though reflects or manifests consciousness. And that gives the experience of that vritti, which is, it's going to end up, because even the sense organs only come into the mind, which makes a vritti. That vritti is known, because consciousness is self-evident, and it is self-evident without any type of pramana, so its own self-experience is, it is known without any knower. If you get rid of the whole creation and there is only consciousness, that non-dual consciousness is self-evident, which means it is known without a knower, it's self-shining. And so that self-shining, self-evident consciousness is really the experience of knownness. And so now say, self-evident consciousness is, which is the experience of knownness, is reflected in the mind. Then that mind, that vritti, is known. Really what is happening is the knownness is superimposed on the vritti. That the knownness itself belongs to consciousness. Consciousness is self-shining, self-evident. And in our language, we would use the word known without a knower, right, to describe that experience. So now when you have this known without a knower consciousness comes into contact with a vritti, then the object of the vritti, the content of the vritti, takes on the nature of the Atma, and the nature of the Atma is the Sat-Chit. It is and it is known. So now every single vritti, it is and it is known. But there is no knower there. Consciousness is not a knower. So why the Sankhyas have this problem with the Atma, which is Brahman, being the one self of all beings, is because they themselves take the Purusha to be a knower. In fact, from the other darshanas, including the Vedanta, this point is considered a weakness of the Sankhya. So it's one of the things about Sankhya that is criticized, because for various reasons they can't establish that. But they criticize the non-dual nature of consciousness of the Advaita Vedanta, because then it would know everything. And so that's the problem. So anyway, that's just a little unfoldment of this to kind of correct the language here. The self is the one that is aware of the mind. You say, in English, if you say is aware, the self is aware. It is performing a function of itself being aware. But the self is not aware. The self is the awareness, the consciousness, that by its nature illumines the mind without any subject-object relationship of the self being aware of the mind. The mind enjoys being known because consciousness is self-evident, is known. And so that consciousness reflects in the mind in the form of knownness, so the vritti is known. So we say in the Kena, if you remove the consciousness from the vritti, the sat-chit from the vritti, then what? And it's not going to be there, first of all, because you've removed the existence. And then if you remove the consciousness, then that vritti is there, but it's not known. Right, so what use is it? It doesn't. First of all, it doesn't exist because you've removed the existence from it. And the existence, which is consciousness, you've removed that too. And so there is the vritti is not there, and nor could it be known if it was there, if it doesn't have the consciousness. So you say the self is the one that is aware of the mind and the one that directs it. Consciousness also doesn't direct the mind. The mind is directed, okay, because it goes on this toward this object or this object. But who is the mind for? The mind is for the sake of the self. It's not directed for its own sake. It's directed for the sake of the self. Like the house is built for the sake of the one who lives in the house. This conglomerate is for my sake. But now say, so it's not that the self is directing it. But now, we can add a little something here. When you say it's the one that directs it, we would look at the sentence actually says kena ishitam, desired by whom patati preshitam manaha, the directed mind patati falls upon its objects through the sense perception and mind. That's what it actually says. Now say the self is just simply abiding, it's not doing anything, it's not directing anything, but the mind is directed. So if we want to give a reason for why the mind, what directs the mind? What directs the mind basically is your raga dveshas, your likes and dislikes. And what are your likes and dislikes all about? Why do you like one thing and not another? It's because of ananda. As long as I am ignorant, have ajnanam, of the source of ananda, then that ananda is superimposed naturally on an object. And that ananda is me, actually. That's my own swarupa. That is my own nature. And so when, because of ignorance, my nature is superimposed on an object, then one way of saying it really is I need to get myself back. Right? Because I've given through the projection. Just like we give all of our, you know, negative things to another person and then shun them because we've projected our dark side under the other person and then run away from that person. You know? We also project our ananda. We project our ananda on a person or thing. And then we run after that to get the ananda back. And we don't think of it as getting the ananda back. There's the ananda and that's what I want. And so the mind, you can say, is directed by raga dveshas. I go toward the things that are ananda for me, you know, and I go away from the things that are dukkha, sukha dukkha. So then you can ask, of course it always goes back into an infinite regress, you know, but then you can ask, well, why are you attracted to that object and not to that object? Now you can say, well, those are vasanas. Those are my vasanas. What are vasanas? You can also use samskaras, but often this is one way the word vasana is used. Vasanas are what we call subtle likes and dislikes, subtle raga dveshas. What that means is I have had in my past positive experiences, right? And so, if something in the world triggers that positive experience, or dvesha, something in the world triggers a negative experience, because they're subtle, they're all there in the unconscious, in the memory banks. It's not like you walk around remembering all the time all your positive experiences and all your negative experiences. But something in the world triggers it. It could be, say, for instance, you had a wonderful relationship with your mother. She was so dear to you. She was so kind and wonderful. You know, and she was your mother, and also she was your very dearest friend. Say, And then somebody comes walking by, and somehow she reminds you of your mother. Or even better yet, she has exactly the same unique accent that your mother has. That's really an extraordinary experience to say one of your parents or family members. We all have our own accent. We don't really realize it, but we do. Yeah. And then you meet someone who has that exact accent. So say your mother was so dear to you, you meet somebody who has that same accent. And that accent is a trigger for all of those warm, positive feelings. And so because of that, then you have a raga toward that person. You want that person as your friend, or you want to spend more time with that person. The mind gravitates toward that person. Why? Because ananda. Because that samskara, that vasana, is triggered. Remember that the word vasana? Vasana means literally fragrance. Like the beautiful rose has beautiful fragrance, this particular rose. They don't all have fragrance, but this rose has a beautiful fragrance. You know? And so say you have a bouquet, then they fill the room with a fragrance. And then if you take the roses out of the room, the fragrance remains, even though the cause of the fragrance is not there anymore. That's called a vasana. You know? So that word vasana, that's how the word is used just in the world. But we use a vasana in terms of subtle like and dislike. Because the object, the person, or the object that you love is no longer there, but it's left an impression, a positive impression. That impression is called a vasana. So it can be the person has left, or situation even, it's left a positive impression, or it's left a negative impression. And those impressions are all there, and now you can take them back, I suppose, through lifetimes, you know, from something that's been happening all along, kind of forever, you know, that all of these subtle likes and dislikes are there, and they're creating vasanas, which then direct your mind in this direction and not in this direction. So that's one way of looking, like, why is my mind directed in this direction? Because something about that person or that situation, even though I've never really been in it before, I have a positive, has a positive pull. And then in this situation, there's a negative, you know, nivritti. It's called privritti and nivritti. So that's one way of thinking about it. But from the standpoint of the self, I'm actually not doing anything. If I'm doing anything, it's like a magnet. But I'm doing like a magnet. I'm not doing anything, but my nature is like a magnet because I am the ananda swarupa. My nature is ananda. There is nothing more beloved than ananda. It is that ananda that projects onto the world. It's a satchit, but satchit is neutral. Consciousness projects onto the world, onto whatever is sattva, consciousness is projected onto that. Whatever is not sattva, consciousness is still projected onto that. As it is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. It's all consciousness. Existence is projected onto absolutely everything. It is, it is, it is, it is. And everything comes into being and goes out of being, but nevertheless, while it's here, it is. So there's a full projection of satchit onto everything. But there's also a projection of ananda onto everything. Ananda is that sense of absolute fullness, all is well with me. And so when that ananda is projected onto a person, then that person will make me ananda. You know? In your presence, I will have that ananda. So I have to get myself back. The negative of that also is, say, someone in the vasana, someone in the past, has as though taken my ananda away. They have behaved in such a way, you know, that my ananda seems to be robbed away by them in one way or another. is that person, that vasana, is very negative because you stole my ananda. It's like saying you ruined me. You stole myself. You know. You stole what is my essential being and left me in misery. So that's dukkha. So this is also, you can say, doing nothing, the self just doing nothing, you know, kind of is the impetus for everything that happens in that way in terms of ananda. So that's one way of dealing with all of that.
This impetus?
Impetus. It's the reason, the impetus, the thing that pushes me toward or away from something. It's the reason, it's the cause of pushing me positively or negative. It impels me. You know, impel? Same idea. Yeah. So how can it be the director of the mind if it has no desire to do so, no will to do so? I think that I answered that, I think. Could you please talk about the relation between Purusha and Prayatna, Kriya, Kriti? Sajasadhana Sambandha. Okay. Well, let me just define these terms. Purusha, it means really the puru, the city, one who's lying there in the five-gated city. It means the Atma. Purusha is the Atma which is Brahman for Vedanta. For the Sankhya, who only uses really the term Purusha, and they don't use the word Atma, Purusha still is the conscious being that's indwelling this body, mind, sense organs. The one who's lying there in this nine, I guess, eight-gated or nine-gated city. If you count all the orifices. So the one who's abiding there in the city. So we use the word Purusha for the Atma which is Brahman, like Purusha Sukta. It's a story of Bhagavan, of Ishwara, that who has that indwelling self that we call Brahman. The Purusha is Brahman, the Brahman which is Atma. So that's what Purusha means. Prayatna. Prayatna, yatna means an effort. Any effort you make to accomplish something. But prayatna is the proper effort. So say you're making efforts to run your business or whatever, and the whole thing just keeps flopping. Okay? You've made all this effort, but it wasn't quite the proper effort. You weren't doing quite what really needed to be done to make that business successful. I'm just making this up, but the prayatna means the proper effort in order to accomplish the task that you want to accomplish. So yatna is just you're making an effort. It could be the proper effort or not the proper effort. It's just yatna, effort. Prayatna means the proper effort. See what I mean? The effort that will actually help you accomplish your goal. Then kriya. Kriya means any type of activity or function. It's also used in a lot of technical ways, like for instance kriya yoga. So then the kriya, those type of activities are very specific. And I know that there's such a thing as kriya yoga, and it comes from the root kri, to do. But the kriyas are particular cleansing techniques and whatnot that are used in kriya yoga. Kriya also means any type of action or function is a kriya, you know. And so it depends on the context. Just take the root kri, to do, to make. And then when you add particular endings on it, it becomes all kinds of different words. But the basis of the word is action. Like karma. Kriya. Karma also comes from kriya. And so kriya yoga or kriya. If in the class we went through these different ways of being able to describe an object. One is jati. Means it belongs to a species. Like coconut tree. There are many coconut trees, so coconut tree is a jati. It has many members. So that's a jati. Then we had a guna, is a quality. So jati, guna. Guna are qualities that will differentiate one object from another. Say you have the jati of German shepherds. One German shepherd is actually all black. One German shepherd is brown and black. One German shepherd is very multicolored. So these are all gunas that are used. One is large, one is small. They're all German shepherds. One is large, one is small. You know, one is pregnant. So these are all qualities, right, that differentiate one German shepherd from another. Then there's kriyas. Kriyas are the functions or the activities that any given entity is performing. They're doing certain kriyas. Like I could say, oh, look at my dog, how fast he runs. That's a kriya. That's something that he does. I'm differentiating that my dog is running really fast, perhaps, and this other dog is just kind of moseying along. And so kriya also is used, the functions and activities are also used to differentiate and to describe an object. And the last one was sambandha. Is that here? Okay, that's a little different. So that comes, that, so that word kriya comes into this, and the last one is sambandha, relationship. We describe objects in reference to their relationship with other objects or with other things. Right? So kriya comes in that respect. Kriti, I'm not sure what the context of that is, but kriti also means an action, as does karma. It comes from the same root, kri, to do or to make, and that ti affix forms it, makes it form a feminine noun, kriti. But I don't recall using that word myself, or I don't recall having it come up in the text that we've been doing, so I'm not sure exactly what the specific use of this word is. And then the next one is sadhya sadhana sambandha. So I'll even add a word to this. The sadhya is the thing to be accomplished. That's the sadhya. The sadhana is the means for accomplishing it. The sadhaka is the one who is using the sadhana to accomplish the sadhya. And so the sambandha means the connection, the relationship. So if you say sadhya, sadhana, sambandha, that would be almost like a question. What is the sambandha? What is the relationship between the sadhana, the means, and the sadhya, the thing that you want to accomplish? So say if I said, what is the sadhya, sadhana, sambandha, you know, in relationship to self-knowledge, right? The sadhana would be the shravana, manana, nididhyasana, called upaya nishta, of the text, the study of the Upanishads, the being taught the Upanishads. And then there's also the sadhana would be the upaya nishta, the antakarana shuddhi, from karma yoga. So these two sadhanas are there, and they are what are the means for gaining sadhya, the thing to be accomplished, which is moksha. So another very more simple way to say it is knowledge as it is through the Guru Sisha Sampradaya handed down, that jnanam that is handed down, is itself moksha. So the sadhya, sadhana, sambandha for moksha is knowledge. And the knowledge itself, the sadhana, that the gain of that knowledge is the moksha. So it's not like cooking. If you say, what is the sadhya, sadhana, sambandha for cooking? Well, learning how to cook, you know, you have to learn how to cook, but that's not going to give you a meal. Your study of cooking will not give you a meal. You have to study cooking, and then you actually have to cook. So first you study cooking so that you can cook, and then you cook so that you can make a meal. So here with Vedanta, the sadhana is the knowledge, is the gain of the knowledge, and the gain of the knowledge is moksha. So that's very different than saying, first you have to learn how to cook, and then you have the meal. Okay, you learn how to cook, and there's the meal. No, you learn how to cook, and then by cooking you produce the meal. In Vedanta, no. Vedanta, the knowledge itself, which has to be taught, right? In that Buddha Sisha Sampradaya, that teaching methodology, knowledge itself is moksha. So that's where the Sajja Sadhana Sambandha comes in. It's very important in understanding the relationship between knowledge and moksha. Because the reason for that is you are already liberated. The problem is ignorance. Why you think you're not liberated is because of ignorance, self-ignorance. And so knowledge alone can remove that self-ignorance. Right? Nothing can remove self-ignorance except for knowledge. Knowledge removes self-ignorance and then there's no more problem because you've always been liberated, you always will be liberated, there's nothing to gain. That's why they call Vedanta sometimes praptasya praptihi, the attainment of the attained, because you already are whole and complete. Please talk again about how to develop a feeling of worthiness when that feeling is not there. Yeah. I think that inner child work is the best for that. Because the little girl, a little boy's feeling is very, very common. It's kind of the ailment of our time, psychological, according to Hans Kohut, great psychologist. The ailment of our time really is not having that feeling of self-worth or being loved or being cared for. It's a pervasive problem. Not for everybody, but for most. And so how to cure that, if at all? I think the best way is that inner child work where you become the good mother or father, you know, giving that child all of the unconditional love, you know, that it didn't get the first time around. Unconditional love is key because sometimes parents, really because of their own what I would call narcissistic wounding, you know, they only love the child and praise the child and tell the child how wonderful and how beautiful, fantastic they are when they've done something. Like, say, they go to piano lessons, and go to their piano, and they practice their piano because they have to, and they practice. And then they go to the recital, and when they play in the recital, they play their little piece perfectly, and everybody claps and cheers, and the mother is so pleased. She's so pleased with her child. You know, just so proud and so pleased. But she's proud and pleased because the child played her piece perfectly and everybody cheered her, and that was the feather in the cap of the mother. Okay. And so that means for the little child, they are always having to earn the love of the parent by doing something special, doing something good. And then they get the kind of the love of the parent, how wonderful you are, what a good girl you are. I'm so proud of you. You're just the best daughter or son that anybody could possibly have. But they only get that through performance, as opposed to just the parents thinking they're the most wonderful little child imaginable just because they're them. That's the only reason. You're the most beautiful, wonderful, special child. I'm so, just can't get enough of you. I love you so much. For no reason. The child doesn't feel, I have to do something, to get some love. They don't feel that at all. They feel that they just are loved because they are who they are. They're loved. That's it. And then that child, internalizes that. And so when you feel loved, period, then you have self-worth. Self-worth is, what is what? I'm loved. I don't know how else to describe it. You know, nobody loves me is not self-worth. Nobody loves me. These are all different words. Nobody loves me. Nobody really wants me. Nobody really cares about me. You know, that inner feeling. because they spent a lot of time when they weren't getting that. There's even, I had some have different clients that in the past. One client had, he had a very kind of intelligent, highly protective parents who were professors, and they were scientists. In fact, they had their own lab and everything. They were scientists, and they were also professors at a university somewhere on the East Coast. And I'm sure they loved their children and all everything, but they were totally preoccupied. They were always holding in their mind their experiments, you know. And so they didn't want to be distracted by their children or the needs of their children, because they were just totally in their minds all the time. Kind of reminds me when I was young, I learned to do some programming. I think we used BASIC and Pascal and some of these other programs. But I remember learning some programming, and is that you're building these edifices in your mind, and you don't want anybody to interrupt you, because you're walking around holding internally this big edifice. And you don't want somebody comes and talks to you, and then the whole thing will go crawling, tumbling down. So it seemed to me that his parents were kind of like that. They were walking around with these experiments in their mind, and they didn't want any disturbance, you know. And so that created a lot of, like, nobody there. Parents were there, but nobody was there for them, because they were good people and all, but totally just in their mind. They didn't even, I don't think they even realized it, you know. And so that, when that's the case, then we have to kind of be the good parent for that little one, and fill them up with the love that they should have gotten initially but didn't, you know. And then that can help quite a bit. And I think another thing that's very, very helpful is going on an imaginal journey where that little girl or boy is getting all the love and attention that they wanted, you know, just in an imaginal realm, like we do with the inner child, right? Just having her or him having an experience, having that experience of being absolutely loved, being absolutely special, the parents wanting to be with you, you know, wanting to spend time with you. Just let them experience that. And you can feel it inside when you're doing it. It's really wonderful. You have to do it more than once. And you have to fill them up in that way. I've told the story before, but it was so moving to me once when every year I would spend time with my sister and her husband. Her husband was just a great, great father. Really amazing. And so loving, and he loved to be with his kids and play with them. And one time it was Christmas, and my little nephew got a Candyland game. I don't know if you remember that game, Candyland. It was one of these board games for little kids. And so he asked his dad to play Candyland with him, to play this game. And so his dad was excited to play with him. That's the first big thing. Both Marianne, my sister, and I were kind of teary, because it's hard to even imagine having a father like that. So anyway, they were both lying down and playing with the board game. And so they played, and the first game was done. And so the little boy goes, "Can we play again?" And the father goes, "Yeah, let's play again." And so they play second game. "Daddy, can we play again? Can we play again?" "Yeah, let's play again." They played like 8 or 9 games. Unbelievable. Yeah. And his father was into it with him, you know. They played Candyland until it was done, you know. And then they went and did something else. That's patience. That's love. That's really enjoying your child, you know. And that little boy, that he had such a wonderful time. He was so excited. He got to be with his father, you know. And they both were engaged in this important task, the Candyland task. And it was something else. So all of those things are self-worth, you know. His father wanted to be with him, wanted to play with him, enjoyed it. It's unbelievable. I never had that experience, actually. And I'm not complaining. It's just a fact. And I think a lot of us didn't get to have those kind of experiences. So when I would see my nephew getting that, it was just, and my sister also. Neither one of us got it, of course. We're the same family. We didn't get that kind of experience. But her eyes would water all her life when the kids were coming up and Jim, her husband, was taking care of, you know, doing his part as a dad. Our eyes just used to water. It was so unbelievable. It's like we got to kind of live that experience and see what that would actually be like. But I would think about those kind of things, giving your little one those kind of experiences where your parents adore you and love being with you and do things with you, you know. It's really, and how much it means to the children, you know. But, you know, you can get bored doing all of that too. And so sometimes it means that your stuff you just put to the side so that you can, you know, give that to your children. So it takes a certain disposition. I don't know if I would really have that disposition, but I would work on it until I had it. Just because of experiencing my brother-in-law and how much, what it means to the children, and how full he would be, you know. So yes. Oh, this is the same question I couldn't bear last time. Try. It requires too much. Can you please talk about anxiety from a Jung and or Vedanta perspective? I can say a little bit about it, maybe, from a Jungian perspective. From a Vedanta perspective, I have to think about it. I have to think about it differently to talk about it, so I don't know if I can do that right now. From a Jungian perspective, like maybe I can kind of mix the two up a little bit. First of all, anxiety can be just like a chemical imbalance. You can kind of be born with like a generalized anxiety disorder. And that means there's something kind of off in the chemistry. And to tame that down, you might need to take some different types of medications, because it's almost, it's just like sometimes with depressions also. They're not necessarily caused by some trauma that happened when you were young. So anxiety also is not necessarily caused by some trauma when you're young, at least as the medical profession is looking at it now. And so why that's important, especially if you're a therapist, you can't just assume that because a person has anxiety that some trauma happened when they were young. You can't have that as such can't just easily make that conclusion. It might turn out that is true. So, but it may not be true. It may just be a physiological imbalance, something wrong with the chemistry, etc., and the neurotransmitters and all of that. But say for instance, it's an anxiety. You're experiencing anxiety because of a trauma that happened when you were young, that is totally kept down in your unconscious. So you have no memory of that trauma. You have no memory at all of what happened, because the doors are shut tightly. Okay, but then that trauma that has a lot of libido, a lot of psychic energy contained there in the body, is kind of like a bubble that's being held deep under the water, that it wants to come up, you know. That bubble of air wants to rise. It wants to rise and come out of the water and join the air. And so there's going to be some pressure for it to do that. But if it's down deep enough, you don't really feel that pressure because it's too deep. So that bubble, nobody even knows about that bubble, even though it's trying to come up. But what if as some things start to shift, let's say, you know, and then that pressure you start to become aware of, it starts to say rise up more closely into the conscious mind, but your defense system doesn't want it to come up, right? It's pushing to come up, the defense system is pushing it down. And but as it starts to want to come up, you're feeling very uncomfortable because you don't want it to come up, because it's a bad memory. It's a traumatic, it's a painful memory. And so that can give what we call that experience of anxiety. It hasn't come up to where you recognize what's going on, what the cause of it is, but there's this underlying anxiousness and discomfort. So that can be a psychological cause for this experience of anxiety. On the other hand, you might just... It can be chemical. It can be your chemistry. And then you're not going to be able to dig anything up. So that's one way to look at that. You could say it's something repressed. Vedanta's really not going to deal with this, but you could say it's like repressed raga dvesha, say if it's a dvesha. A dvesha, think of dvesha instead of just a dislike. Is something that, why do you dislike something? Because it's hurt you in one way or another. Right? And so dvesha is a hurt. You don't like that thing because somehow it has threatened you or hurt you or scared you. That's a dvesha. And so say there's these dveshas, you know, in the unconscious that are triggered sometimes, like for instance, somebody's eyebrow goes up in a way that happened before, and it was a very bad experience with that person, father and mother or person, very bad experience. And so when you get around that person and your eyebrow does that, you get feel really awful. You can feel really anxious, really awful. You have no idea why, because you don't even know anything about their eyebrow, you know. You don't have any memory. But your unconscious does. They see that the unconscious sees that eyebrow go up, and then this nightmare that's being held in the unconscious is somehow triggered, and you feel very, very anxious and very uncomfortable. Yeah. I don't think I have much more to say.
Can I just ask?
Sure. If you're feeling that something like that?
If you have this trauma that you don't remember, it happened. So
but you feel something. You feel something down there, but you don't know what it is. Yeah. I think, you know, like, there's a lot of preverbal traumas. You know, like, say you're only one or two or three and you can't really talk yet. You don't know what's causing it. And that can't tell you. The child can't tell you because she doesn't know how to talk or doesn't know how to talk, but you feel it. So what I would do if I suspect that, I would just go in and sit with that, feeling that discomfort, and imagine it as just a little baby or a two-year-old or something, and hold her and talk with her and say, I'm feeling all of your discomfort, but I'm with you now, or something that makes sense to you. And just assume that she can't, is too young to talk to you or tell you about it or anything. But what could happen? Either somebody hurt her or abused her, or somehow she was left in the crib and nobody picked her up, or your parents are in some weird situation. They just went out and did their own thing and you were left at home all alone. I mean, all of these things happen. But then you're too young to have any type of real memory of it, other than this feeling of fear or terror or terrible worry. And so then I would just go, and not knowing exactly what it is, you can be with her and talk with her, hold her, be very, very patient, you know, and feel and do things waiting for something to shift a little bit with her, you know. And you have to do it over and over. Another thing about doing this inner child work is that you can't just do it once and then go away and never come back. Because for that, that child inside will feel abandoned. So if you, for instance, say you go and you are with this little girl, and then you leave and forget that you've ever done that, and you're off again. Well, that's traumatizing. So it does matter. So if you develop that inner relationship, you kind of need to see that through and take it seriously. Because we tend to only think this is real, and we don't think this inner world is real, but this inner world is real too. And you go in, you know, you go in a subtle form. You know, it's the buddhi going in. Buddhi is subtle. It goes in and deals with that, which is also subtle, and is held there, and you come into relationship with that. And there's some release, you know, some trust is built up, and then a lot of things start shifting and happening. The last thing you want to do is just leave and abandon it. Then it'll all just shut down again, and maybe it won't open the next time you come. So you have to be responsible about that type of work, and give it the reality that it deserves. It's just a different order of reality, but that doesn't mean it doesn't that it's not real. It's just a different order of reality. You have to stop in this era of thinking the only reality that there is this physical reality that we perceive through our sense organs. That's not true. So then we don't know about that. We don't take seriously all these other orders of reality, nor do we even consider using them, you know, or being with them in a way that's very curative, or also a way that is very enlightening in terms of talking with deeper wisdom figures and things like that. There's so much knowledge there. Even though your buddhi in the end has to know whether to accept or reject what a lot of these inner figures or wisdom figures, you know, or anamanas, all these different types of figures say, it's your responsibility in terms of how, to what degree you bring it out into the world. But to think that there's not anything going on in there is a huge miss of more than half of your own consciousness in terms of the psyche. I don't mean the atma, but in terms of what you have access to in terms of your psyche. In other centuries, that they had so much access that somehow the scientific revolution kind of shut all that down, and we only took as real everything like this. But boy, you lose so much, and your psyche needs to be able to breathe. It's all been shut down and suffocating. And it opens things up so much when you start going into relationship with different levels of the psyche.
Yeah. Can I ask one thing related to the continuity or the following the inner child work once you start? What's your experience, or what do you think, or what's your experience with family constellations? And I refer to the fact that I know more than a few persons who something is triggered from the unconscious, but then you might not be followed up by the person if the person is not the right person. So something comes up, and then you don't know how to hold it and how to.
I didn't hear a word. You might not be something you said by that person. You used a word I didn't hear. You said you might not be something by that.
The person who facilitates the family constellations might be a person that either you don't see, you decide yourself not to see her or him anymore, or or maybe this person is not a therapist, so she's able or he's able to trigger something from your unconscious, but then she's not able to help you. So I know more than one person who then went to therapy after family constellation experiences. So I don't know what's your...
Well, family constellations is like therapy called family systems therapy that doesn't have to really bring anybody in the family. I mean, you can do it as just an individual family systems. You actually kind of introject the family system, like the mother and the father and your brother and sister and all of these and yourself. Who are you in that family system? Like they have different names, like one of the, you know, there's the parentified child, and then there's also like the scapegoat, the one who's the black sheep or the scapegoat, and then there's different, you know, the youngest one. There's different names for all these particular types of roles you might find yourself playing. And then the problem you have, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but anyway, the problem that you can find yourself in is that you always find yourself playing out the role that you played in the family constellation over and over and over again. And in fact, you don't really know how to play one of the other roles. You know, like say, for instance, you're the oldest child. The oldest child in a family, say there's four or five kids in the family and you're the oldest child, just by the structure of that family constellation, you're always the one who, in more or less, takes care of the other ones, all of the other children. You're responsible for the well-being and the happiness of the other children. Also, you're the respected elder among the children because you're the oldest. And so you've always been that way all growing up, from being a little girl or a little boy all the way through, you know? And so you don't even know how not to be that way, because that's your experience growing up in the family constellation. So the way that you relate to others is always as the oldest child. Now imagine being the youngest child. That's a total, you're in a totally different place in the family constellation, because in a way the youngest child is the last baby of the group in the family. And so the babies are always the beloved ones. I remember, because we had six children, I was the oldest. And then there was always a baby, right? And the baby, we always loved the baby. We wanted another baby all the time so that we could always have a baby in the group. So the last baby is really the adored child by all of the other brothers and sisters. You know, it's the adored child is the one that you do everything for, that you look after, that you take care of, and so cute, and everybody thinks they're so cute, and they stay as the cute one because they're the baby all the way up. So everybody loves the baby and does everything for the baby, for the youngest child, and for the parents also. The parents had a horrible time with the first children because they have no idea what to do. One of my sisters would say that I feel so sorry for my first son. He was so hard on him trying to, you know. By the time the last child came along, then that lucky little boy gets to do whatever he wants, basically. I mean, compared to, you know. And so that's a totally different constellation. And that little child, the little one, will just expect that they're wanted and loved and adored and all that. That's all inside, unless there's something really, you know, there could be sickness or mental illness in the family or something. But I'm just saying in a normal constellation. Then often, you know, one of the middle children can feel like they don't exist because they're the elder child who has all, you know, all this responsibility, and they're the respected one because they're the elder. And then there's the loved one because the little baby. And then the middle child who is almost invisible, so they can have an invisibility complex. And then there's the one that never does the right thing, the scapegoat, you know. The parents are always angry at that one. And so that you grow up, you know, whole family constellation, you grow up in that constellation, and now you're out in the world, but your psyche has been formed around this constellation. Mm-hmm. And so if your place in the constellation is something that gives you self-worth and self-worth and that feeling of being wanted and feeling loved, then that's great, that's perfect. But what if you're in that constellation, you're in a place where you're the scapegoat or you're the invisible child? So these are all the things they talk about and say in therapy, and it's really helpful to know what your place is in the family constellation, and how is each member of the family, and is there any scapegoat in the family, and who is the oldest, and how are they, and who are you in it? And it does give a lot of understanding. But I don't know how to kind of psychologically or relate as a therapist to your question.
I think that I'm missing the English word, because probably it's not translated as family constellation. It's like a role, it's a group therapy where basically you bring up a traumatic episode of your life and then you actually play a different role. So if you used to be the scapegoat, you choose like Johan is going to be my father and Jen is going to be my mother. And then the facilitator.
Gestalt. It's called Gestalt.
Similar. Similar. It's not a Gestalt, but it's similar to the Gestalt. Yeah.
So I haven't really done that myself, but I know about it. I know that type of therapy. I don't do family therapy. But what we would do as an individual therapist is we find that inner that constellation inside of yourself in your own psyche. Playing out. But they also do it in family therapy, especially Gestalt. Om
Swasti Prajapya Paripalayantam Nyayena Magena Mahimahishah Ko Brahmanebhyah Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yam Kshobahitah Brahmana Santu Nirbhayah Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah Sarve Santu Niramayah Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkhavat bhavet Asato ma satgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityor ma amritangamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om. Oh.
Something that can happen in the body, sure. People come with constellation, there's some drama played out, shit. Maybe it resolves to some, but then it's usually like unfinished.
Yeah.
Story.
Yeah.
And then that was like, they need to talk about it more.
Yeah.
Yeah, to get more of
yeah.